Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. I am still Josh Beiser, and we have a great cast for you tonight. We are returning to a topic that is near and dear to me, and that is preserving video games and making sure that we can still play them who knows how many years down the line. It's a topic that I know doesn't get enough coverage, especially in the mainstream media, and especially in the consumer's eye. But nevertheless, it is an important one to talk about, especially with the idea of video games as being art and being something we should still be able to access way after their shelf date. So, my guests tonight are from the recently founded National Video Game Foundation, who is making it their goal to help preserve and educate people about the importance of being able to play these games, again, long after the system is gone or long after it's easy to acquire normal copies. And I'm sure we are going to have a great cast tonight. So first, please welcome the director of the National Video Game Foundation, Ian Simmons.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Ian. And please welcome Professor of Digital Media and another member of the National Video Game Foundation, James Newman.
Hello there.
Hi, James. It's great to have you on as well. Guys, it's a pleasure to have you on tonight. I know for those of you listening, both James and Ian are in the UK, so there's a five-hour time difference. So it's always interesting to have these international conversations.
It's really exciting to me. So on a personal level, Josh, and as a firm Springsteen fan, it's really exciting to be talking to someone who's in New Jersey. This is properly personally exciting for me. It's an honor to be speaking to you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ian.
Not at all. Is that boring? Do people say that to you all the time? Is that like a boring thing to say to someone?
I would say no.
You say yes.
But I know when it comes to New Jersey, it's pretty much Bruce Springsteen and New Jersey are one in the same for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
All right. So, guys, how are you doing, I guess, for you? How are you doing this evening?
Oh, really good. I mean, I'm really excited because I'm talking to someone from New Jersey. So, for me, this is the closest I've ever been to Freehold. So no, really, really good. Yeah, we launched the foundation a couple of weeks ago now, or a week ago now, and it's been really building on a lot of the work really that James and I have been doing for the last over a decade probably, with the Game City Festival, the National Video Game Archive project that we did, and the National Video Game Arcade that opened just over 18 months ago. It's a really good next stage in, I think, giving a kind of new, a kind of higher level framework really to everything that we've been doing. So it's a really good time.
Yeah, and definitely before we get started, congratulations on founding the National Video Game Foundation. As you said, it's been, in terms of this recording, it's been about a week or so. By the time it goes up, it should be about like a month, I think, here or there.
Right, okay. So we're in, I don't even know what the date is, right? It's late September?
Yes.
Late September,
yeah.
Yeah, don't worry. I forget the date as well, especially when you start doing all this stuff. It's very easy to forget what time it is, and all of a sudden it's like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and there's three of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get into talking more about game preservation, especially the challenges you guys have faced, I guess let's start off with a little bit more about introduction. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit more about your backgrounds with the game industry, and whoever wants to talk first, feel free.
Ian, do you want to kick off?
Silence for 20 minutes. I worked as a games journalist and wrote about video games in the kind of mid-2000s, which is when I met James, who at that point was just writing one of the first kind of academic textbooks, which is, I think it's probably fair to say, has become kind of the academic reference work for game studies, which at that time was a really, really kind of emergent field. Yeah. I guess it's more mature now, but it's then it was really kind of establishing itself. So I met James in 2004, something like that, when we were running some quite kind of small events in pubs of people talking about kind of geek culture stuff that we thought was interesting. And James came and did a talk upstairs in a pub about his book, along with a guy called Dave Doak, who was one of the GoldenEye 64 team. And at that time was at Free Radical making Time Splitters 2, I think they just made, or were just about to make. We found a kind of common interest in finding new audiences to think about video games in different ways. So really kind of taking taking a different kind of discussion about video games to different kinds of people. And that led to us doing a book together, which is called Difficult Questions About Video Games, which I will probably, I think, return to some of the kind of themes and questions in this discussion. But it was about taking what seemed like childishly kind of provocatively simple questions like what is a video game, and inviting developers and fans and writers and people from around the world to kind of to give an edited collection of answers to these different questions. So what is cheating? How can you tell if a game is any good? These kind of like really seemingly simple questions that revealed quite a lot really about the kind of time and about their respective authors. So from the book, I started making bigger kind of events about video games, and we worked on a show at the South Bank Centre in London, which was a sort of prototype festival, as it seemed. And then that really led to Game City, which is a festival we started in Nottingham. Which was really an attempt to find a different way of interpreting video games for people. So to that day, so I spent a lot of time as a journalist going to shows like E3 and, you know, and that model of engaging people in games, which is based around get the biggest room that you can, fill it with the most games that you can, put people in front of the games, hope they understand them. You know, that's kind of it. Right. And that always struck me as a really bad way of interpreting and translating games for everyone. And that's not to say that they were necessarily like aspiring to do the same things as well, because of course they're not. But even given that, I always found the experience of those kinds of shows personally to be kind of alienating. So what we tried to do with Game City was create a festival in the way that people tend to create kind of arts festivals. So site-specific, lots of different places around a city, you know, are kind of serendipitous, works at lots of different levels for lots of different audiences, but use video games as the jumping off point for them. And the great thing about games is they allow you to talk about, you know, kind of anything. So you can talk about, and almost like games are almost the least interesting thing you can talk about, right? Because you can talk about art, you can talk about music, you can talk about, you know, all the constituent parts of what they're made of. So Game City was this kind of sometimes quite radical, sometimes quite experimental thing that reinvented itself every year and tried to problematize the assumptions we might have about how people think about games. I'll stop talking there and let James jump in whilst I have some wine.
Okay. Yes, well, whilst Ian sort of partly introduced. So I was and remain an academic. So I was writing books and articles about games at a time when kind of very few people were. So I was kind of started off doing a PhD in the mid-90s and ended up sort of moving into what became known as game studies. As Ian said, we met because we'd done some writing and we sort of met online and did an event together. That was partly about finding new audiences, really about language as well, about finding a way of describing games that wasn't, you know, the sort of the kind of tropes that we come used to hearing and using as well, like the controls are really fluid. So we wanted to try and find a new lingua franca and really get to the heart of how we could talk about this stuff and what was interesting about it. So we kind of concentrated on events and writing. And as Ian said, we did Difficult Questions About Video Games book, which brought together lots of different people and asked those kind of insistently childish questions. Maybe I'll pick another thing. So we wrote again for the BFI. We wrote a book called 100 Video Games, which was part of the Screen series that they published. And so the point of that was it wasn't the 100 best or best-selling games. It was just 100 games that we chose that we thought said something, told you something about the kind of history of games, whether that be from the point of view of, you know, level design or graphics or sound or interface, whatever. So it's an interesting project in and of itself, picking those 100, and it created lots of, you know, debate. Why was this title not in? Why are those, you know, why have you included those? And that was really interesting, seeing, trying to sort of think about what those kind of canonical titles were. But I guess the thing that really struck us, I suppose, and really sort of drove us forward to the next sort of phase, I suppose, of what we went on to do, and I think is really what's informing the work we're doing now, was that in the writing of that book, we realized that a large number of the 100 games that we were picking, you already couldn't easily play.
Yeah.
So you couldn't access them, or maybe you could, but it wasn't like 100% legal. But even if, you know, and even if you could, it was some sort of version of the thing that was then played with a different interface, and it wasn't quite the same game. And even in the process of writing the book, you know, games that we would be talking about were becoming harder to, you know, harder to find. Mm-hmm. And so I think we sort of thought there must be somewhere like an archive of this stuff. Either the industry's doing it, or museums, the heritage sector will be doing it. And we looked around, and we did a lot of research, and we, you know, did some pilot studies and some work, sort of, you know, just scoping this. And it turns out that really no one was doing that sort of stuff, or rather lots of people doing it, but not in a very coordinated way. Mm-hmm. So lots of fans were doing it. Some museums were collecting things, but maybe as design objects or, you know, cultural artifacts, but not necessarily as games.
Yeah.
And didn't necessarily have comprehensive game collections. They had game, you know, objects in their collections because, you know, it was part of their remit, but not the totality of it. So that led us to found the National Video Game Archive, which was a project we originally started with the National Media Museum in this country. And the collection still exists. It's part of the Science Museum's collection of new media. And really starting to think about what those questions about what it would mean to preserve games and what materials you'd need to preserve games as well. So we were really keen on it not just being a collection of code, which is not to say that's not important, but we really wanted to focus on the sort of culture of gaming as well. Mm-hmm. So the material objects are different, cassettes, boxes, you know, cover art, instruction manuals, but also all the sort of fan materials as well. So the scope of the collection could include cosplay costumes, you know, fan-made maps, walkthroughs, FAQs, as well as the sort of production documents as well, those design sketches and, you know, design documentation. So we really set ourselves quite a wide remit in terms of exploring what kind of range of materials you might want to preserve, what was available, what was being done to keep that material, and how we could help coordinate it. And more recently, as you mentioned, with the National Video Game Arcade, which opened in March 2015 to the public, we've really become interested in thinking, okay, so we've got some materials we can concentrate on trying to preserve, but then what do we do with those? Mm-hmm. So how do we interpret them? How do we make sense of them? How do we exhibit them? Mm-hmm. So really in one sense, the festival has been a sort of, you know, a living experiment, trying to work out how to do that, how to put games in front of people and how to draw out what's interesting about them without just putting them in a big room and saying, okay, play this for 15 minutes. But the arcade in particular, as a building, as a series of gallery spaces, has been a really targeted experiment on our part, thinking about how you curate collections of games, how you present them in interesting ways that don't always involve playing, for example. So we're interested in, you know, making new interfaces and devices and exhibits that explore aspects of design or gameplay, as we are, you know, putting coin op machines in a room and, you know, encourage them themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was definitely a great introduction, and I think you guys are definitely in the...
We're out of time.
We're done.
But I think you guys are definitely in the right place talking to me with Game Wisdom, because I've been doing a lot of that kind of talk regarding having a dialogue about very abstract concepts of game design, which, as both of you said, there really aren't a lot of those discussions about. Over the last... Well, at this point, we're going on 4 years of doing this. I've talked about everything from what makes a good achievement to different kinds of progression, why randomization can help or hurt a game. And as both of you guys are obviously aware of, it's very hard to properly talk about these things. And either both in terms of educating people or trying to convince them that it is something important to talk about. And it's definitely been part of the goal of Game Wisdom to be able to have these discussions and be able to present them in a way that anyone can understand.
Right. And I think one of the and the last point was always the most important one for us, I think, Josh, is this thing of, like, it's probably quieted down a bit the last few years, but the whole, you know, kind of discourse around are games art? Can games be art? Are games important? Are, you know, all that kind of thing. Which always, you know, always, I think, struck us as kind of just like boring, really, apart from anything else, you know. The starting position that we always took with the festival was games are, they might be good, they might be bad, they might be worth something, they might be worthless as kind of individual titles, but they're interesting, you know. So, you know, just given the amount of mind share that they have, they are self-evidently interesting things. And our kind of starting point really was to kind of leap over any need to validate them or otherwise, and just start from the point of view of, well, are they worth our consideration, or what, you know, one's consideration, right? So that could be an academic discussion, but most importantly, and much more kind of valuable and a bit really interesting, is, well, how do you create you know, a kind of broader, more accessible kind of literacy about games that could be kind of useful for people. And as the years have gone on, the more we've done this kind of work, that point of focus of the kind of accessibility of how we might interpret and think about games has become more and more and more important. And partially that's probably because we both, you know, had kids during that time as well, and your perspective over over the things that you play and the time, you know, that you're aware is being spent on playing them kind of changes. But it's taking that discussion and that language and that kind of, not so much language, you know, but that kind of point of access of thinking about these things and making it something for everybody at different levels is really, I think, where we're at now.
Yep, and I'm sure you guys have never heard of this question before, but I'm sure there's always the ever-popular, are games art? I'm sure neither of you have ever asked or heard anyone ask you that question.
I've never ever been asked that. That's the first.
And I think that is a good point. At this point, I think the video game industry has become established. It has. We don't really need to prove ourselves anymore in terms of what video games can provide. And I mean, this last
year, I don't know. I'm not sure that's true. Provide to who?
Yeah.
Like, so I think, you know, video games can prove themselves economically, certainly. And they provided, you know, a sustainable business model. And I don't mean that during that. And that's a really important thing, right? They provide a lot of jobs and they provide a lot of kind of cultural growth in a whole load of different kind of sectors. I think, though, they're only really just beginning to scratch the surface. And I really mean this in terms of who they could before and the things that and the things that they could do, you know? So I think there's a whole load of questions that video games have kind of yet to answer about quite how kind of durable they can be, about how many different constituencies of our you know, kind of society they can speak to. In some respects, I think we're really in the kind of shallow end of that. Sorry, not to jump in on your point there, which I fear I may have done. Sorry.
No, that's all right. But yeah, it is, again, like, as we're talking about these topics, a lot of the stuff really hasn't been discussed, and I know there's always been that boundary between, I think, game designers and especially about, like, the mainstream media / game journalism. And it is very hard to find places that will delve into these topics where it's more than just talking about, like, the news of the day or the hottest game releases, and more, again, about the importance of preserving video games or why or the challenges of running a studio. And even something as simpler, I should say, quote-unquote simple, as what it means to actually run your own game studio. There's very little information out there, especially for people who are trying to enter this industry for the first time. A lot of what has taken shape with the game industry has been almost like the quote-unquote Wild West. There's really no established rules or laws in terms of doing things like this.
Absolutely. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, I mean, certainly what we do at the NBA at the moment with the, you know, the kind of availability of tools in a way that just hasn't been the case really since we had kind of open computing platforms in the early 80s, you know. It's so exciting now that anyone can make a game, you know, and not only the, not just because the tools are cheaper or even free in a lot of cases, but the culture and the I guess the sort of peer community around them is starting to get to the point we can really encourage that kind of you know, that kind of expression. Like, it's massively empowering a moment for video games, I think. And I think the whole question of like whether games can be art or not is going to be like, we have no idea what games can be yet, you know, and we're going to get shown what they can be by someone we don't expect. You know, it's not going to be, I don't think, a kind of graduate of a game design course necessarily. It's going to be someone who takes some of these tools and really turns them on their head. And because the access is there now, I find that the most exciting thing about being around games at the moment.
And I guess, though, I absolutely agree with what you're saying about the, you know, the availability of tools and that feeling like a return to that, that period, certainly in the UK in the 80s and in lots of other places too, with the sort of birth of the home computer and that real, that sort of hotbed of creativity. But I think in addition to that as well, one of the things that's really interesting is the ways in which games are being kind of played with, I suppose. So things like Let's Plays and the sort of phenomenon of the sort of YouTube, that notion of kind of spectating and making video content that both uses and, you know, makes use of games. I think there's just these really fascinating kind of spaces opening up where people are using games to create those kind of serial narratives, and you know, emerging these new kinds of celebrities who aren't necessarily game makers, but they're making things with gaming platforms or with gameplay. I think we're starting to see whole new sort of forms of, you know, forms of entertainment, forms of expression that were hard to predict even a few years ago. But again, a sort of ephemeral, and although hugely important to certain, you know, certain constituencies, certain communities are almost sort of under the radar in other quarters.
And I think it is going to be very telling to see what's going to happen with the game industry, especially by the end of this decade. The thousands or last decade was really the time where things became standardized, I think, in a lot of ways in terms of design and the appeal. And then this decade has really been sort of like the rise of the indie market. And as both of you were saying, the ability to make games these days has never been better than it is now. We can see everything from like 5-10 man teams, even just one person, being able to design and make their own game. And there's now a market for it, and there's now even the option via Kickstarter and crowdfunding to get that game funded. And I think it's also very interesting to see, again, as we talked about, like how the video game industry has evolved in the eye of popular culture over the last two decades. I remember, again, the 90s, where it was considered just this fad, just like many people thought it was going to be in the 80s. It wasn't really looked up on, you know, people. It was pretty much mocked, I think, on like TV and stuff like that. And then over the last decade, it's really become part of the popular zeitgeist. I mean, very recently, we're seeing esports on television. I never thought I would see it, at least in the United States.
Yeah, I think in particular the kind of leap the games are made. So there's still a kind of incongruity sometimes where, so I don't know if you watch House of Cards, the Netflix show, there's still like one still has a little bit of a sense of kind of product placement. I don't know. I still get that a little bit with not particularly with House of Cards, even though, you know, sort of kind of what that was, but the sense of games being like not quite naturalized, you know, not quite kind of. And I think there's kind of examples of that starting to kind of drop into sort of narrative television at least. But but there's still this, I don't know, I still, there's still this kind of moment of weirdness mm-hmm. when someone starts playing a game, yeah. you know, and everything's interrupted while they do this. It seems like a slightly strange thing for people to do. But yeah, you know, esports is tremendously interesting and this huge, huge phenomenon that's, yeah, absolutely kind of leaping into what we kind of now call mainstream kind of media consumption. But the reality is, like, I think that the kind of volume of consumption in the kind of streaming media is going to outstrip anything that the kind of straight to air broadcast has got anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, it's more about the entire network's kind of swapping place.
Yeah.
There's a few things there. So there was a BBC documentary, I'm going to say it was last year, it was fairly very recently, looking at the phenomenon of esports. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting that there would be a fairly mainstream documentary about esports, but at the same time, there was a sort of incredulity, that incredulity that Ian mentioned. It was kind of, oh, what's this kind of weird thing? And it was very much couched in that
like a zoo.
There was something odd about it. And it was kind of sort of, you know, at the same time trying to understand it, but was positioning it as being an odd, strange sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's that. And I think that point, though, about the consumption of gameplay, I think, is a really interesting one. So I don't think, I'm not aware of any particularly good metrics when it and you know data on this sort of stuff when it comes to YouTube or Twitch, but yeah, sort of anecdotally, and I think the beginnings of the research that I know are doing just the shift in gameplay spectatorship mm-hmm. and that becoming a quite significant proportion of people's kind of gameplay consumption. So there's plenty of games that, you know, I've played, and I know I get a new group of students each year who are increasingly consuming games and consider themselves to have played games that they've never actually played mm-hmm. in inverted commas. And that's something that I think, I mean, certainly from, you know, from my sort of perspective as a game studies academic, the thing that you think games are about, the sort of defining feature of them, is their interactivity. You know, you press a button and something happens on the screen. So it seems kind of counterintuitive to think that so much consumption and so much pleasure and so much understanding of the game might be derived by watching somebody else play it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I think we're kind of unprepared for, which is surprising and exciting. And it's looking at the ways in which Twitch and YouTube are used. Mm-hmm. And the emergence of, you know, the importance of things like commentary to make, you know, to make sense of that, which I guess comes full circle with the points we were talking about before about interpretation and sort of making sense of this. Because, you know, I really, really like watching Street Fighter tournaments, but I don't really know what's happening half the time. But the commentary makes or breaks that. You know, sometimes I really still don't know what's happening, but a really rich commentary that can explain the nuance to me is just utterly fascinating. So that the emergence of those kinds of roles, those kind of narratives, whether it's, you know, there's sort of celebrities that create their serials in Minecraft or, you know, Mario Maker, or if it's commentary on esports, those sorts of things I think are changing what gameplay is and might be part of that kind of process of, if not, you know, normalizing it, then certainly, you know, I think making it more of it's a different kind of entertainment form, certainly, that doesn't only require you to be holding a, you know, a joypad. Mm-hmm. And I think that stuff is really, really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Just at the beginning of, I think that seems like a big shift already, but I think we're still at the beginning of that sort of emerging and finding new kinds of broadcasting models and new kinds of celebrity and thinking about what gameplay might do in different ways that doesn't always involve, or certainly where the play is not only just about, you know, pressing buttons. It might, you know, you're playing with that stuff because you're interacting via Twitter or through YouTube comments or, you know, live, you know, chat in Twitch, for example. And there's a kind of playfulness there, and you think the game is sort of extending out into those places too. Mm-hmm. Really interesting.
Yeah, and that kind of distinction or that kind of deviation to watching people play video games as well as playing them or even not playing them in some cases has been a major part of really how things have changed in terms of perceiving video games. I remember, again, from the 90s where you either play video games or you read about them in the Once a Month magazine, and that was it. And now today with the internet and YouTube and Twitch, you can actually have online shows dedicated to playing video games or watching games you would never play in real life. And it's really, I think, thrown a lot of people out of the loop in the sense of what it means to not just watch games, but to advertise, to market them. I mean, we see a lot of indie developers these days really pursuing the Twitch stream YouTuber market first and foremost, and rather than, you know, your traditional media or your traditional sources.
Right.
I was thinking about the ways in which games are developed with that audience in mind, an audience who might be consuming that, you know, through watching somebody else's play.
Mm-hmm. There's a share button on the PS4 controller. Yeah. You know, it's like it's completely intrinsic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's constantly recording your game.
Yep, definitely. And I mean, hell, I think any one of these topics we could easily dedicate an hour to hour talk to, I think, with the three of us. And as you said earlier, it is there's just a lot here to digest when it comes to the game design and the industry itself. I mean, anyone who's listened to these casts knows that we can, who knows how long, if we didn't have real life constraints, how long we could just sit here and talk about even just one topic of the game industry for who knows how many hours.
It's a terrifying thought, Josh.
I don't even know how much longer we could spend on this, but to try to at least keep somewhat on track then, we haven't really talked about this yet, at least in terms of this cast, but for the people listening then, what is the National Video Game Foundation, or what is like the goal of it for you guys?
Okay, so the point of the foundation is to develop and interpret the kind of role of video games in culture, in education, and in society more broadly. So what does that mean? So that means we focus on video game heritage and interpretation, and we do that through our work in the National Video Game Arcade and the exhibitions that we work on there and the preservation efforts that we've talked about in the last half an hour. We work in as an extension of that in events. So we do the Game City Festival. We do things like touring shows. We do lots of kind of conference talks and that kind of work. We work in education. So we work in deploying and understanding video games across different areas of the curriculum. So not just what in the UK and possibly in the US you call STEM subjects, so science, technology, engineering, math subjects, but across other areas too. So what would it mean to use video games in geography or RE or physical education or, like different areas. And we work a lot with schools who come into the arcade and we teach them about kind of game literacy and how games are made, and games as a process and that kind of work. And then finally, we work in kind of advocacy and policy. So how do other cultural sectors, so museums, sports, arts, how do they interface with, understand, and get value from video games and makers of video games in their work, right? Because a lot of the kind of arts establishment is really interested in games because they're interesting, intelligent things, but it's quite hard to find a way into them. So a lot of the work we do as well with the foundation is being a kind of meeting point of other research or cultural institutions and video games. So quite often we form the kind of bridge between those agencies to help them kind of understand and discover what they might be able to do for each other. So the foundation really is a way of connecting that. Is a way of giving that some sort of covenant and some kind of focus over and above what the arcade did before. So that's what we're setting out to do. To some extent, it feels like we're right at the beginning, but the reality is we've been doing this in different forms for a kind of decade. But because a lot of other institutions have kind of grown and changed, and attitudes to videos have grown and changed kind of around us as we've been doing this. It's quite and all the stuff we said really about kind of tools and process kind of earlier on. This feels really like the right moment now to be really pushing this on. Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to add, James?
I think that is a fantastic summary of what the foundation is. I think
thank you very much.
You're very welcome. There's a moment when lots of things are colliding, lots of organisations interested in games and kind of wanting to know what they can do with them. So to come back to Ian's point before, trying to explore how they can be used across different sectors for different audiences. So yeah, we feel like we've been doing this for a long time, but it's come together, and there's a sort of that kind of narrative through thinking about preservation and history and interpretation, and those sort of driving forces in a way which have encouraged us to think about how to interpret this stuff and how to make sense of it, even though the things themselves might not be there. I think we've sort of ended up coming up with some kind of interesting models, or at least asking some interesting questions about how we can make sense of this stuff, and for who it's for. Who are we interpreting it for? When we start to think about it's preserving video games, we've got a variety of different materials, but also a variety of different audiences too. So we need to really think about what they could be useful for, how they can be useful, and what we can save and how we can then interpret it. And we don't have those answers, and we're learning from lots of people as well. So we're part of networks across the world, but also we're learning from the people who come to the arcade as well. They have fantastic ideas, and we're part of these new sort of emerging practices of spectating and making Minecraft videos, and we need to learn from them too and understand how these things are actually being used. So the foundation's really about sort of, I guess, coordinating some of that work, really.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So as we talked about earlier in the cast, you guys, for those listening to this cast, it will be about a month since you guys started. How many members do you have at the National Video Game Foundation right now?
Oh, so we have at the arcade in particular. So in total, there's about 38 mm-hmm. Members of staff. So that's about 10 to 15 full time. And then we have a lot of people who work in the arcade, working with the public, who are are kind of part time and just work when the galleries are open.
Okay. And as you said earlier, you just said a few seconds ago, that this is really the best time, in your opinions, to do the National Video Game Foundation. And I think that's a very interesting, as we said earlier in the cast, regarding sort of again like this rise of communication, the rise of videos and whatnot. It's really becoming the video games has really come, I think, a lot grander in like the last few years than I think it ever has been.
Sorry, grander?
Yeah. Bigger. It's become more, it's really, I think, taken on a whole new shape in the last few years.
Just say a bit more what you mean. That's a really interesting comment. I'm not sure. Will you say a bit more what you mean by that?
I mean that it's really becoming like it's not just an industry anymore around the studios, around a developer-publisher relationship. Today you have everyone from indie teams making games to even your regular people making YouTube videos and Twitch streamers. Like it's no longer just defined by a developer and a publisher. It's really become this mass cultural thing these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really I find that really exciting and interesting. And the thing I like most about video games at the moment is to some extent how kind of, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, but how kind of shambolic they are, like, and I mean this in the best possible way, but you talk to colleagues from the museum sector or the film sector, and you tell them how it works with video games, and it just seems like a wild west.
Yeah.
How do you deal with exhibition rights? Mm-hmm. It's all just out there and kind of up for grabs. And I really, really love that. And I love the way that works in the games. And I really like, there's lots of things I don't like about video game culture, but in terms of that kind of absence of needing to ask permission to do things, at one level at least, I really, really, I really, really enjoy it. And there's some fantastically creative people with it. It's an exciting time, and it's an exciting group of people to be around. It's getting more and more exciting as these different voices enter it.
Yeah, definitely. And with Game Wisdom itself, I've had a chance to speak to a lot of indie developers, and as you said, Ian, it really is the Wild West. There is no guidelines for what it takes to make a video game or be in this industry. I mean, I've spoken to people who've everything from learning about game design in college to just, you know, one day deciding, I want to make video games, let's do that. And it's just fantastic because there's never really the same story, just like how every video game is different. So is everyone's experience. And as you said, it is great. There are definitely some aspects of video game history and game culture, I think, that could do with some improvement. And one of them, which I think will probably sort of help frame our discussion in the next few minutes about preserving games, is the fact that it's very hard to find credible information. On the internet, I mean, you can type in game design and get, you know, 500 different websites all with, like, different discussions. And it's very hard to separate the noise from the signal in a lot of cases.
Right. I mean, I can only really agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the... So while it's absolutely true that, you know, we're at a very exciting time, there's lots of opportunities to make games because of, as we've said before, because of the, you know, the availability of tools, the availability of platforms for whether it's, you know, distributing games or distributing, you know, videos about games. But at the same time, the stuff is remarkably fragile. Mm-hmm. And I think, I suppose we've got, like a number of people have, we've kind of got to this point where we're really aware that we're losing our ability to access a lot of the material that, you know, certainly, you know, when we were writing that book, the BFI book, we were really aware that a lot of the stuff that we were writing about was probably from, I guess it was from our childhoods, from our sort of early adolescence, and it was already not available.
Yeah.
And there's a real sort of, you know, threat there that this material that we think of as being really, you know, culturally valuable, as being like foundational to the sort of, you know, the history of the development of, you know, of games as a form, won't be available to the next generations of developers. So although there's a push, you know, to encourage people into, you know, into and to see game development and design as a you know, as a career path, it's increasingly difficult. And unless we act, it will, you know, that will continue to be the case. Increasingly difficult to find the sort of resources, historical resources to draw on, to look at how the kind of conventions of genre or representation, you know, developed over the years. So I think it's that's also a kind of one of the reasons why the moment feels right. There's a lot of people, a lot of groups who have become, you know, very aware of that and want to do something about it in terms of whether that's, you know, preserving and thinking about modes of interpretation, but it's also about thinking of sort of more preservation friendly, you know, development workflows. So it's thinking about, you know, the sort of longevity of that material as part of the sort of process and thinking about leaving that legacy. And so yeah, I think that sort of moment's really interesting one as well, as we're you know, we're, you know, collecting things like, you know, sort of oral histories as well as, you know, as well as sort of as material objects and code. But I think there's a lot of people now are starting to realize actually this stuff is remarkably sort of fragile, and we think it's going to be around forever because games appear to be everywhere, and that it seems odd to be thinking that games might disappear when there's never been, you know, more platforms and more opportunities to play and develop. But at the same time, we're losing stuff. You know, there's, you know, every month, every year, studios go out of business. There's, you know, online activation servers get deactivated, and, you know, platforms become unsupported or obsolete or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's another reason why I think it's an exciting moment, and there's a lot of challenges. And I think we're still working out what the questions are. But there's a lot more people working on asking the questions and answering them than there were even 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point about really a lot of people in the industry, and even the consumers themselves, have trouble thinking about things in the long-term sense. As we're seeing, I mean, it's only been about two decades, and it's becoming very hard to find NES, Genesis stuff. And this was like the 90s were really the time where the game industry blew up. So these things should be very easy to get, very easy to access. But that's not necessarily the case. I think it goes back to the larger issue of seeing games as both a product and as an art form. And for a lot of people, they see it as a product, much like you would a television or a computer. When the next model comes out, you know, you get rid of the old one, you get the new and fancy one.
Right.
And that was, so at the risk of just using the whole podcast to plug our books, a couple of years ago, and this is really coming off the back of that work on, that sort of early work on preservation, and the archiving work. So I did a book called Best Before, which was a kind of pun about thinking about preservation, the problems of preservation. And one of the, you know, one of the ideas there is really thinking about how we think about what games are. And it's exactly the point you're making. We tend to think of them as in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. So they become obsolete. We don't, and that's, you know, that happens in, and this is not, I'm not pointing the thing, this isn't blaming, but this is a, you know, it's a general truism that, you know, through advertising and marketing and sort of retail practice, technology design, we think of these things as becoming, you know, they become obsolete, they either are or aren't supported through backwards compatibility for a certain amount of time, but, you know, our attention always gets fixed on, you know, it's the next game, mm-hmm. the best game is always the one, you know, that's coming. And so by, you know, previews and, you know, the next generation, it's even, you know, even the language we use. So kind of fixed on this idea of, you know, games constantly improving and getting better and technology improving, new consoles, whatever. One of the things that we thought about in that, you know, that period and then that piece of research was thinking about how we've come to view games through advertising, through marketing, mm-hmm. through technology design as technology that becomes obsolete. As games that are kind of superseded, almost, you know, like we might imagine a piece of software, you know, a piece of productivity software that has new features added and the old one becomes, you know, it's not the flavor of the month anymore. Mm-hmm. So we have these kind of cycles of, you know, sort of pre-ordering, excited about the next game, and then the sort of pre-owned market, you see these kind of games move through the pre-owned market, dropping in price until they eventually drop off the shelf altogether. So we're kind of concerned that, I suppose that was part of what motivated us and getting just thinking about how vulnerable that stuff was. And although it seems to be so present and surround us, and as we've said, you know, many times, that there appear to be so many opportunities to play, so many platforms to play on and develop for, but that material is remarkably vulnerable, remarkably fragile. So we wanted to try and work out, I guess, what it would mean to preserve video games. Because video games are more than just code. Yeah, they're played by people. Mm. And they're played by people in really different ways. We both are, but I'm, you know, particularly interested in things like speed running and this kind of super play performances, and you're really aware that there's markedly different ways of playing the same game. So we became quite interested in the idea that, like, the outcome of game preservation might not just be to make a game playable and to ensure that it can be played in the future, but also that actually recording the way in which it was played was really important, and the multiple ways in which it was played and played with. So whether that be speed running or hacking games, you know, the stuff that people are doing with Mario Maker, for example, like, it's really important to be able to document what the range of things people have made with Mario Maker, you know, is. That, because that range of things, that's what Mario Maker is at the moment. So preserving it and making it available and being able to play it in 5, 50, 100 years time doesn't capture what it meant, you know, as a sort of, you know, as a practice, as a culture, as a phenomenon. So we're sort of thinking about, you know, the scope, the object of what preservation might be, which is absolutely not to say that it isn't, you know, entirely the right thing to do, to continue to try through whatever methods, whether it's original hardware or continuing emulation efforts, to try and keep games playable. But that's only part of the, you know, part of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, for us, we've tended to focus more on that notion of, you know, trying to capture the sort of cultural meaning of games, the social meaning of games. So thinking about how they're played, thinking about ways of capturing that, but also thinking about ways of exhibiting that that doesn't require you to play them.
Yeah,
because we forget, you know, games are hard.
Yeah.
If you want to show somebody, you know, if you want to talk about that bit in, I won't spoil anything, but, you know, a particular game where an event happens, it might be 50 hours into the gameplay, and it might require you to do a whole bunch of things that have to happen in a particular sequence. You've got to know about, you've got to execute. So we wanted to find ways of, you know, of you know, picking on those moments that didn't require you to, you know, to be particularly knowledgeable or skillful necessarily, or just to take that much time, because in a, you know, in a gallery setting, you can't spend 50 hours grinding through a game, you know, before before you get to that bit that we really want to sort of focus on.
Yep, and
there's a whole bunch of really kind of interesting questions and challenges there about how you do that and what materials you use. So we've ended up using a lot of video, which is, I guess, why we're sort of interested in things like spectatorship and performance.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, Jimmy, about being able to show some of these things off. I mean, you mentioned the speedrunning as a very good example of that. I've been watching a lot more speedrunning lately. I was watching the Summer Games Done Quick that just happened this year, and it is really quite fascinating to see games played at this level. And it's even more fascinating when you start seeing them like understand like glitches and little exploits that they're not like hacking the game to do this stuff. This is simply understanding and mastery of the game to get these things to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have a bunch of work on this, but the Minus World in Super Mario Brothers is a really good example. So it's a feature of the game, but it requires. Mm-hmm. There's a particular technique, there's a particular point in the level, a particular set of techniques which are reasonably difficult to pull off. Mm-hmm. But then you end up, if you can trigger it, and there's a fascinating story behind how it happens as well, which is another thing that's interesting to delve into, looking at the way the kind of code is manipulated, but also the way code shared between different NES games at the time. It's how people work out what's happening there. But this maneuver you can execute that takes you into this thing called the Minus World, which in the 80s was this sort of mythical place that maybe was like the beginning of a whole World 9, but actually turns out to be effectively a kind of glitch. There's a bunch of data is misread, and it just so happens it doesn't crash the game, but generates effectively kind of procedurally generates this whole new level, which you can explore, but you can't escape.
Yeah.
And then it turns out also the Japanese version of the game, Famicom Discs, has about 256 Minus Worlds as well. So for our interest, that's a really fascinating thing.
Cool. Now,
but for us, presenting that through video, through somebody executing that, just as showing a speed run of Super Mario where the game is completed in just just a few minutes, it transforms what that game is. And once you've seen that, you go and then play the game, so we might have the game playable next to this exhibit. You look at that game in a very different way, and it enriches, I think, your understanding of it. It helps you understand how it's working, how it was designed, how it's played. So those things can only really come through those other materials that are sort of in addition to you playing it, but help you play it, help you play it differently or think about different techniques, ways of approaching it.
And another point that I want to touch on, we definitely don't have time to talk about in depth tonight, but there's also the fact that a lot of these classic games we really don't see being made in that style or that kind of design anymore. It's pretty much been the basis of GOG's popularity, with the fact that there are games from the 80s and 90s that were amazing games that they literally just don't make them like that anymore. And every year it's becoming harder and harder to get those games. I mean, GOG is a good solution, but it is still, only a fraction of all the games that are being made.
Yeah. And actually, there's a really important point as well. That so two things, I suppose. One is we don't only want the good games.
Yes.
No one's experience of being a gamer buying games has been exclusively wonderful games.
Yeah.
And actually, the games that if it was might be bad design, it might be that game with the glitch where the boss never arrives and you can't complete it. These are important parts of what of what the history of games is. So we need to be really careful that we don't sort of accidentally end up just creating the games we think are important at the moment, or the games that are best, and sort of replicating those top 100 lists. But similarly as well, that if we think about things like the NES and the library of games that were made for the NES, not all of those games are easily and readily available, and that's the NES. Wait till you find the obscure consoles and platforms and handhelds from that period. And there, the attention, the sort of effort that goes into either emulating or collecting, it probably means that some of those, the more major, well-known platforms are going to be, more well cared for. But the Dragon 32 was the first computer I ever owned. It's a kind of TRS-80 clone made in Wales. Was made for a couple of years. Most of the things I did with it were games that came on cassettes. I still have most of them, and not many of them work anymore. but he doesn't really feature in part of the, you know, in the sort of the mainstream history of gaming. And I'm not sure how much effort there is, you know, expended on, you know, documenting that platform. And again, that's a fairly well-known one compared with the myriad clones that were around at the time. Mm-hmm. So there's whole areas of sort of game history which are comparatively unexplored.
Yep, and that's a really good point there, James, regarding that's not just about the top 100 lists. Mm. It's about all these games. And, I mean, seriously, we could easily spend like an hour on that one topic alone. Yeah. There is one question. I know we are running, we're getting close to the hour, but there's definitely one question I want to ask both of you, especially being part of the National Video Game Foundation and about the preserving these games. And again, it has to do with essentially coming with a solution. As we've seen, when we talk about preserving video games, there's definitely different avenues we can take. The simplest would be literally just having these consoles and games around. But as you two are no doubt aware, there's some major limitations with that. The other options will, of course, be video. And then there's the argument about emulation or virtual consoles. We've seen this with PSN, the Wii U Virtual Library, GOG, etc. And they also have their unique pros and cons. So my actual question for both of you, and again, this is probably another hour discussion, I think, but from your points of view, what do you think is a viable solution for game preservation, or is there even a viable solution?
So right now, I think that solution is in a mix of all the things that you've just said, right? Because one of the things that you didn't mention is actually one of the biggest barriers to all of this, which is the law.
Yes.
Right? The capturing of bit streams, the emulation of old hardware and software is in many territories, most territories, illegal, right? Fundamentally, in and of itself, but like that is a big, expensive problem to solve. So I guess I don't want to speak for James's behalf, but in the face of that, you look at the other alternative strategies that we have available to us, and you look at, you know, the kind of pragmatism of trying to solve a legal problem, a plastic deterioration problem, a bit rot problem, and I think. Certainly from our point of view, with the work that we do at the Arcade and at the Game City Festival, the answer can only be in looking to the shared, kind of collective histories and performances of players, because they're the only things that we know we can like relatively reliably capture. So I think it's a mix of all of those things. There certainly isn't any kind of silver bullet answer to this. But I think that, you know, the kind of legal problems around it, particularly in a globalized game industry, are one of the biggest single challenges that it has. So for us, having spent like quite a lot of time fairly deeply embedded in the kind of preservation effort, we felt, and I think I'm right in speaking with James here on this too, is that just from the point of view of just hours in the day, of where you're going to put the limited amount of time that you actually have to make any sort of impact in this effort, where do you put that, and where can you have the most impact? And for us, I think that's an interpretation. That's in documentary. That's in performance. That's in the capturing of the capturing and preservation of gameplay rather than the ability for people in perpetuity to be able to play the game on individual hardware. And that's probably where that approach kind of splits away a little bit from the preservation efforts that we started with. So that's not to kind of dodge giving you a definitive answer, but I think it's how I feel at the moment. It's where we put the kind of emphasis of our efforts.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I think the legal issues are significant. They are partly about acquiring ROMs. They're also about, you know, licenses and IP and rights, and it's incredibly complicated. Yes. I mean, in some senses, there are some things that are distinct to games. There are others that other, you know, media preservation, you know, practices have to deal with as well. I suppose what I've come at this from there's another way to think about it, I suppose. And it sort of depends although all of those techniques and strategies are probably in some combination appropriate and right, it probably depends who we're talking about doing game preservation for. So we probably need to also think about, you know, who the audience for this is.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the discussions about, you know, emulation, for example, notwithstanding any of the kind of legal questions, but a lot of the questions might be around, okay, so they're not quite, most modern emulators do some sort of, you know, kind of clutch somewhere along the line where they're dropping frames or don't maybe render graphics or sound in quite the way that, you know, an aficionado would want, perhaps. And actually, for a lot of uses, that probably won't matter. If you are frame reading on a, you know, fighting game, for example, that really does matter. So it depends whether you want to give the kind of impression of what that game was, or if you really need the kind of frame accuracy, and if you're doing some sort of analysis about, you know, the way the game looked, you want a really accurate rendering of the graphics, for example, or to be able to hear the sound as exactly as it was. So it's sort of, to some extent, it's going to be, you know, this is going to be a distributed effort, and there's going to be a bunch of people tackling this problem for their own audiences, for their own constituencies, with their own techniques, and all those things will kind of come together. But I think, as Ian says, I think our particular take on this is probably, we think an interesting question is about preserving gameplay. Documentation is like a really interesting part of the kind of puzzle for us. So thinking about how the things are played, which isn't to dodge that question about, you know, doing the emulation. There's a bunch of people working on that problem and making, you know, staggering progress with it. But that notion of kind of accounting for the ways in which games can be played. Mm-hmm. And thinking about play as being something that we're trying to preserve. So accounting for that and documenting that and recording it and capturing it, because the way the games are played, the interactions between players and the code and the interface is, I think, you know, for us, it's like that's a really interesting part of what games are. And that's something that you don't necessarily get if the game is made available to you and you can play it, but you play it in a particular way, but you don't capture all those other meanings, ways of playing, techniques, strategies.
Mm-hmm. All right, yeah. And
there's a point, on James's point with that, there's a point, though, that's even, in terms of who we're preserving them for, there's even kind of less deep than that. And I really noticed this at the arcade, right? So we often have school trips come to the MVA, and we can sit, a 9-year-old down in front of an Atari 2600 and hand them a joystick, and they won't know what it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't mean that, you know, like, and why would they? Mm-hmm. You know, where else would they encounter this stick with one red button with it? Like, they literally don't know what this object is. And this is, but, you know, so James is absolutely right. There's a question around the kind of fidelity of emulation in terms of drops of frame rate and that, you know, those kinds of issues. But also there's a much simpler, more fundamental thing to do with kind of hardware literacy, that some people have not encountered screens that don't respond when they touch them, you know, or this is a real thing, you know, and haven't we? Even we've been doing this for like 10 years, and now it's interesting seeing this kind of second generation of people coming into buildings like, you know, the NBA, and seeing objects that are completely alien to them. Mm-hmm. And it's a joystick, you know, it's things that we just took completely for granted. So we can't. Video games are so unstable. It comes back to the kind of chaos we sort of alluded to earlier on, and that's why they're so exciting. But that's also why they're such a kind of interesting challenge to preserve and interpret, because they're not like film. They're not like music. They change form in so many different kind of material ways, as well as kind of generic ways, all the time. And it's really it's a really weird place where you can't really rely on many assumptions at all, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And it is weird to talk about these things, like, as you just said, Ian, that we are in a generation that has grown up exclusively with smartphones and the latest gaming consoles, and they've never heard of things like the NES or the SNES, and there really isn't much work being done to display and educate people on that. And we talked about this, I think, with our last talk about game preservation that I had, I think, about like a year ago, that what's going to happen in 10 years from now? What's going to happen in 15 years? Like, we talk about the NES and the SNES as, you know, these, you know, forgotten relics, but what about, like, the PlayStation 2 or the original Xbox? In 10, 15 years from now, will we still be able to play those games?
Well, it's interesting as well that when I think about, like, you know, game history, I think about things like the NES and the Mega Drive and those sorts of consoles. It makes me feel old. Well, my student refers to PlayStation 2 as a retro console.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
yeah. And this, but you know, your point of reference, like, you know, it changes significantly because there've been these like huge transformations.
Yeah.
So if your first point of entry into games is via Minecraft or an iPad or a phone, then yeah, you don't, as Ian says, that sometimes, you know, looking at a cassette or a joystick does seem like it doesn't seem connected with the practice or the hardware, the interfaces that you're using. So that's why I say I think the audience, the reason you're doing game preservation will to some extent govern the kinds of techniques that you'll use, and which is why all of those techniques are completely, you know, valid and viable. They won't be necessary for every application. So, just the minutiae of the kind of replication of a gaming experience in an emulator will be absolutely. So yeah, the audience, the reason you're doing game preservation is going to affect and influence the kind of strategies and techniques that you use, and all of the ones you mentioned are absolutely, you know, appropriate, need to be, you know, continually developed. But they will, you know, the strategy that is most appropriate will, you know, to some extent be governed by what you're trying to do. So those minute differences that we see in, you know, the replication of a game in, you know, between an emulator and the original console, even between different emulators, will be absolutely critical in certain applications, but they will be, you know, they won't be important in others. Yeah, we'll end up with lots of different sort of a distributed effort, I guess, where lots of people are tackling this from a variety of different ways because their organizations, their institutions, their audiences have different different interests. If you're interested in doing code analysis, then you need the source code because you want to look at it, you know, and you want to do that kind of work with it. So the work we're doing on, you know, preserving play won't solve those problems at all, but I think we're sort of, you know, I think everyone has recognized that. You know, no one strategy can solve all this, and no one organization or institution can solve all this, which is why it needs this work needs to be coordinated, needs to be joined up, and we all need to work out, you know, what the questions are, and we'll try and solve them in our own way, I think.
All right. Again, it's definitely a fascinating conversation, and so many different topics we can easily expand on for who knows how long. But I know for the folks listening, it is getting late where James and Ian are, so we will have to wrap things up in the next few minutes. And while we're talking, I know Ian is Googling me to figure out if I'm close to Bruce Springsteen, which I am not, unfortunately.
So look, which town are you in, Josh?
I'm in Cherry Hill in South Jersey.
Is that north of Little Egg?
Possibly.
Cherry Hill.
Ian's going to come here, I think. I think that he's playing his...
Well, do you know, we were in New York earlier on this year, and we almost came out. We ran out of time, but I did want to drag my wife and family out to Asbury Park. But they wouldn't do it. Cherry Hill. Here we go. Cherry Hill Mall.
I'm like about 10 minutes away from the Cherry Hill Mall. This is good. I think this is what they tell you not to do. Like, don't give your information to strangers. I think this is what...
No, it's fine. You're perfectly safe. Don't worry. Okay. So you're like... Sorry, don't carry on.
All right.
So it's very hard to just... How far... It's quite big, isn't it, Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in England, we think everywhere's quite small. We think a long drive is like 2 hours.
This is good. Folks, you may need to help me at some point in the future.
Yeah, you might need to edit this part. If any listeners are in Asbury Park, I would like to come and visit and be shown around. Please, thank you.
Before we get going, there's one last topic I want to bring up here, and this is what you guys were telling me about in email. That
this isn't another Springsteen thing, is it?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay, right.
But you guys were telling me you have an event coming up. Again, for those of you listening to this cast, we're recording this in late September. The cast should be up in early October. But if you guys have a second, if you mind telling the folks, what is your planned event that's happening?
Cool. Yeah, so it'll be the 11th Game City Festival, mm-hmm. Which is happening in Nottingham from October the 26th to the 29th.
Okay.
And it'll be based around the National Video Game Arcade. It'll be the first time we've done it with the foundation in place. And there'll be tons of games to discover, things to learn, kind of gigs to come to, and creators, really, of games there to unpack what they've been doing for the public in ways that they wouldn't have seen before. So yeah, we'd love anybody to come who's nearby. Everybody's welcome. The whole thing's free, lasts for the 4 days, and it'd be great to see everybody there.
Awesome. Do you have anything to add, James?
No, just look forward to seeing as many people as possible to come. It's a really fun event. Lots of talks, lots of things to play, lots of sort of games in development as well, to play and to sort of help shape. It's great. You should definitely come.
Awesome. All right. Well, I know we are definitely running late, at least by you guys. I know we were originally saying 45 minutes to an hour. But again, as we said, we can easily spend 2 to 3 hours on just about any topic regarding the game industry. And I would definitely love to have you guys back on at some point. I mean, hell, we can easily have, you know, parts end to infinity at this point. It's just like when I had the developers from Plastic Games on. If they're listening right now, we could have another infinite cast, I think.
It would be a pleasure.
Infinite cast, what would that even be?
Yeah, someone will...
We're going to have to talk about the Jersey thing to do that.
Yes.
But...
All right. Before we say goodnight then for tonight, my final question for both of you is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to end the cast on, besides Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, really? I was going, okay. Right, okay. No.
How about you, James?
Let me apologize for my poor Wi-Fi this evening as well and making your editing job harder.
But, that's all right. All right.
No, it's been a pleasure. It's been fun.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Josh. Cheers.
It's been really good.
Yeah, awesome. It was a pleasure meeting you guys. Like I said in email, I'm a big supporter of preserving video games, and again, about being able to talk about them in elevated sense compared or in relation to what we see in like the mainstream and what other sites tend to cover. All right. So with all that said, we're going to wrap things up here for tonight. For those of you listening, thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have multiple options available. For guest pieces or being future podcast guests, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. We are always looking for new people to come talk with us. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates of new content, as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. Check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily videos of game spotlights, Let's Breaks, examinations, and my own game design vlog, A Critical Thought. And last but not least, be sure to check out the Patreon campaign to help support Game Wisdom and get the funding we need to keep going, growing, and supporting ourselves. You can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom. Donations would be greatly appreciated. And I know for the National Video Game Foundation, I think you guys are also using Patreon or crowdfunding, right?
Yeah, so people, if they go to the site at themvf.org, they can find out how they can become patrons of the MVF, absolutely.
Awesome. So be sure to check that out as well. And as a special note, if Bruce Springsteen just so is happening to listen to this cast, I can get you.
I was there in Coventry a few months ago, Bruce. Come on, invite us over.
There you go, Bruce. If you're listening, Ian has something he wants to talk to you.
It's very important.
Mm-hmm. All right. So with all that said, thanks so much for tuning into this week's cast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.